Chapter 19. Garrick first became conscious of the smell. Thinking about it served as a rallying point for his attention, and he could start to creep out of the hiding place in his mind. For Garrick, these returns to reality were always accompanied by a feeling of light-headedness and a heightening of the senses. Colours were vivid, skin sensitive to the touch, tastes and smells sharp and clear. He lay on a straw mattress. The sun was bright, but he was in the shade. He lay on the veranda of the stone-walled hospital above Rourke's Drift. He thought about the smell that had brought him back. It was a blending of corruption and sweat and dung, the smell of ripped bowels and congealing blood. Garrick recognized it as the smell of death. Then his vision came into focus, and he saw the dead. They were piled along the wall of the yard, where the crossfire from the store and the hospital had caught them. They were scattered between the buildings, and the burial squads were busy loading them onto the wagons. They were lying down the slope to the drift. They were in the water and on the far bank. Dead Zulus, with their weapons and shields strewn about them. Hundreds of them, Garrick thought with astonishment. No, thousands of them. Then he was aware that there were two smells, but both of them were the smells of death. There was the stink of the black, balloon-bellied corpses swelling in the sun, and there was the smell from his own body and the bodies of the men about him, the same smell of pain and putrefaction, but mixed with the heaviness of disinfectant. Death wearing antiseptic, the way an unclean girl tries to cover her menstrual odour. Garrick looked at the men around him. They lay in a long row down the veranda, each on his own mattress. Some were dying. And many were not, but on all of them the bandages were stained with blood and iodine. Garrick looked at his own body. His left arm was strapped across his bare chest, and he felt the ache start beating within him, slow and steady as a funeral drum. There were bandages around his head. "I'm wounded." Again he was astonished. "How? But how?" "You come back to us, cocky," cheerful cockney from beside him. "We thought you'd gone clean bonkers." Garrick turned his head and looked at the speaker. He was a small, monkey-faced man in a pair of flannel underpants and a mummy suit of bandages. "Doc said it was shock. He said you'd come out of it soon enough." The little man raised his voice. "Hey, Doc, the hero is completely mentos again." The doctor came quickly, tired-looking, dark under the eyes, old with overwork. "You'll do," he said, having groped and prodded. "Get some rest. We're sending you back home tomorrow." He moved away, for there were many wounded, but then he stopped and looked back. He smiled briefly at Garrick. "I doubt it will ease the pain at all, but you've been recommended for the Victoria Cross. The General endorsed your citation yesterday. I think you'll get it." Garrick stared at the doctor as memory came back patchily. "There was fighting," Garrick said. "You're bloody well tooting there was," the little man beside him guffawed.
"Sean?" said Garrick. "My brother? What happened to my brother?"
There was silence then, and Garrick saw the quick shadow of regret in the doctor's eyes. Garrick struggled into a sitting position.
"And my pa? What happened to my pa?"
"I'm sorry," said the doctor with simplicity. "I'm afraid they were both killed." Garrick lay on his mattress and looked down at the drift. They were clearing the corpses out of the shallows now, splashing as they dragged them to the bank. He remembered the splashing as Chelmsford's army had crossed. Sean and his father had been among the scouts who had led the column. 3 troops of the Ladyburg Mounted Rifles and 60 men of the Natal police. Chelmsford had used these men who knew the country over which the initial advance was to be made. Garrick had watched them go with relief. He could hardly believe the good fortune that had granted him a squirting dysentery the day before the ultimatum expired and the army crossed the Tugela. "The lucky bastards," protested one of the other sick as they watched them go. Garrick was without envy. He didn't want to go to war. He was content to wait here with 30 other sick men and a garrison of 60 more to hold the drift while Chelmsford took his army into Zululand. Garrick had watched the scouts fan out from the drift and disappear into the rolling grassland, and the main body of men and wagons follow them until they too had crawled like a python into the distance and left a well-worn road behind them through the grass. He remembered the slow slide of days while they waited at the drift. He remembered grumbling with the others when they were made to fortify the store and the hospital with bags and biscuit tins filled with sand. He remembered the boredom. Then, his stomach tightening, he remembered the messenger.
"Horseman coming!"
Garrick had seen him first. Recovered from his dysentery, he was doing sentry duty above the drift. "The general's left his toothbrush behind. Sent someone back for it," said his companion. Neither of them stood up. They watched the speck coming across the plain towards the river.
"Coming fast," said Garrick. "You'd better go and call the captain."
"I suppose so," agreed the other sentry.
He trotted up the slope to the store, and Garrick stood up and walked down to the edge of the river. His peg sank deep into the mud.
"The captain says to send him up to the store when he gets here," Garrick's companion came back and stood beside him.
"Something funny about the way he's riding," said Garrick. "He looks tired."
"He must be drunk. He's fallen about in the saddle like it's a Saturday night."
Garrick gasped suddenly.
"He's bleeding. He's wounded."
The horse plunged into the drift, and the rider fell forward onto its neck. The side of his shirt was shiny black with blood. His face was pale with pain and dust. They caught his horse as it came out of the water, and the rider tried to shout, but his voice was a croak.
"In the name of God, prepare yourselves. The column's been surrounded and wiped out. They're coming. The whole black, howling pack of them. They'll be here before nightfall." "My brother," said Garrick. "What's happened to my brother?"
"Dead," said the man. "Dead. They're all dead."
He slid sideways off his horse. They came. The impis of Zulu in the formation of the bull. The great black bull, whose head and loins filled the plain, and whose horns circled left and right across the river to surround them. The bull stamped with 20,000 feet and sang with 10,000 throats until its voice was the sound of the sea on a stormy day. The sunlight reflected brightly from the spear blades as they came singing to the Tugela.
"Look, those in front are wearing the helmets of the hussars," one of the watchers in the hospital exclaimed. "They've been looting Chelmsford's dead. There's one wearing a dress coat, and some are carrying carbines."
It was hot in the hospital, for the roof was corrugated iron, and the windows were blocked with sandbags. The rifle slits let in little air. The men stood at the slits, some in pyjamas, some stripped to the waist and sweating in the heat.
"It's true, then. The column has been massacred."
"That's enough talking. Stand to your posts and keep your mouths shut."
The impis of Zulu crossed the Tugela on a front 500 yards wide. They churned the surface to white with their crossing.
My God! Oh, my God! Whispered Garrick as he watched them come. We haven't got a chance. There's so many of them.
Shut up, damn you!
Snapped the sergeant at the Gatling machine gun beside him. And Gary covered his mouth with his hand.
Grabbed O'Reilly by the neck, shoved his head in a pail of water, rammed that pistol up his...
sang one of the malaria cases in delirium, and somebody else laughed. Shrill hysteria in the sound.
Here they come! Load!
The metallic clashing of rifle mechanism.
Hold your fire, men! Fire on command only!
The voice of the bull changed from a deep, sonorous chant to the shrill ululation of the charge, high-pitched frenzy of the blood squeal.
Steady, men! Steady! Hold it! Hold your fire!
Oh, my God! Whispered Garrick softly, watching them come black up the slope. Oh, my God! Please don't let me die!
Ready!
The van had reached the wall of the hospital yard. Their plumed headdresses were the frothy crest of a black wave as they came over the wall.
Aim!
60 rifles lifted and held, aimed into the press of bodies.
Fire!
Thunder, then the strike of bullets into flesh, a sound as though a handful of gravel had been flung into a puddle of mud. The ranks reeled from the blow. The clustered barrels of the Gatling machine gun jumped as they swung, cutting them down so they fell upon each other, thick along the wall. The stench of burnt black powder was painful to breathe.
Load!
The bullet-ravaged ranks were reforming as those from behind came forward into the gaps.
Aim!
They were coming again, solid black and screaming, halfway across the yard.
Fire!
Garrick sobbed in the shade of the veranda and pressed the fingers of his right hand into his eye sockets to squeeze out the memory.
What's the trouble, Cocky?
The Cockney rolled painfully onto his side and looked at Garrick.
Nothing, said Garrick quickly. Nothing.
Coming back to you, is it?
What happened? I can only remember pieces of it.
What happened?
The man echoed his question.
What didn't happen?
The doctor said... Garrick looked up quickly. He said the general had endorsed my citation. That means Chumford's alive. My father and my brother, they must be alive as well.
No such luck, Cocky.
The doc's taken a fancy to you. You with one leg doing what you did, so he made inquiries about your folk. It's no use.
Why?
Asked Garrick desperately.
Surely if Chelmford's alive, they must be too.
The little man shook his head.
Chelmford's made a base camp at a place called Insandiwana. He left a garrison there with all the wagons and supplies. He took a flying column out to raid, but the Zulus circled around him and attacked the base camp. Then they came on here to the drift. As you know, we held them for 2 days until Chumford's flying column came to help us.
My folk, what happened to them?
Your father was at the Insandiwana camp. He didn't escape. Your brother was with Chelmford's column, but he was cut off and killed in one of the skirmishes before the main battle.
Sean dead?
Garrick shook his head.
It's not possible. They couldn't have killed him.
You'd be surprised how easily they did it, said the Cockney. A few inches of blade in the right place is enough for the best of them.
But not Sean. You didn't know him. You couldn't understand.
He's dead, Cocky. Him and your pa, and 700 others. The wonder is we aren't too. The man wriggled into a more comfortable position on his mattress. The general made a speech about our defence here. Finest feat of arms in the annals of British courage, or something like that. He winked at Garrick. 15 citations for the old VC. He was one of them. I asked you, Cocky, isn't that something? What's your girlfriend going to do when you come home with a mucking great gong clanking around on your chest, eh? He stared at Garrick and saw the tears oozing in oily lines down his cheeks. Come on, Cock. You're a bloody hero. He looked away from Garrick's grief. Do you remember that part? Do you remember what you did?
No.
Garrick's voice was husky.
Sean, you can't leave me alone. What am I going to do now that you're gone?
I was next to you. I saw it all. I'll tell you about it, said the Cockney. As he talked, so the events came back and fitted into sequence in Garrick's mind. It was on the second day. We'd held off 23 charges.
23. Was it as many as that?
Garrick had lost count. It might have been but a single surging horror. Even now he could taste the fear in the back of his throat and smell it rancid in his own sweat. Then they piled wood against the hospital wall and set fire to it. Zulus coming across the yard, carrying bundles of faggots, falling to the rifles, others picking up the bundles and bringing them closer until they too died, and yet others came to take their place. Then flames, pale yellow in the sunlight, a dead Zulu lying on the bonfire, his face charring and the smell of him mingling with the smoke. We knocked a hole in the back wall, started to move the sick and wounded out through it and across to the store.
The boy with the assegai through his spine had shrieked like a girl as they lifted him.
Them bloody savages came again as soon as they saw we were pulling out. They came from that side, he pointed with his bandaged arm, where the chaps in the store couldn't reach him. And there was only you and I and a couple of others at the loopholes. Everyone else was carrying the wounded.
There had been a Zulu with the blue heron feathers of an Induna in his headdress. He had led the charge. His shield was dried oxhide, dappled black and white, and at his wrists and ankles were bunches of war rattles.
Garrick had fired at the instant the Zulu half turned to beckon to his warriors. The bullet sliced across the tensed muscles of his belly and unzipped it like a purse. The Zulu went down on his hands and knees, with his entrails bulging out in a pink and purple mass.
They reached the door of the hospital, but we couldn't fire on them from the angle of the windows.
The wounded Zulu started to crawl towards Garrick, his mouth moving and his eyes fastened on Garrick's face. He still had his assegai in his hand. The other Zulus were beating at the door, and one of them ran his spear blade through a crack in the woodwork and lifted the bar. The door was open. Garrick watched the Zulu crawling towards him through the dust, with his pink, wet bowels swinging like a pendulum under him. The sweat was running down Garrick's cheeks and dripping off the end of his chin. His lips were trembling. He lifted his rifle and aimed into the Zulu's face. He could not fire.
That's when you moved, Cocky. I saw the bar lifted out of his brackets, and I knew that in the next second there'd be a mob of them in through the door, and we'd stand no chance against their spears at close range.
Garrick let go his rifle and rattled on the concrete floor. He turned away from the window. He could not watch that crippled, crawling thing. He wanted to run, to hide,
That was it. To hide. He felt the fluttering start behind his eyes, and his sight began to grey.
You were the nearest to the door. You did the only thing that could save us. The Hanar wouldn't have had the guts to do it.
The floor was covered with cartridge cases. Brass cylinders, shiny and treacherous underfoot. Garrick stumbled. As he fell, he put out his arm.
Christ! The little cockney shuddered. To put your arm into the brackets like that? I wouldn't have done it.
Garrick felt his arm snap as the mob of Zulus threw themselves against the door. He hung there, staring at his twisted arm, watching the door tremble and shake as they beat against it. There was no pain, and after a while, everything was grey and warm and safe.
We fired through the door until we had cleared them away from the other side. Then we were able to get your arm free, but you were out cold. Been that way ever since.
Garrick stared out across the river. He wondered if they had buried Sean or left him in the grass for the birds. Lying on his side, Garrick drew his legs up against his chest. His body was curled. Once, as a brutal small boy, he had cracked the shell of a hermit crab. Its soft white abdomen was so vulnerable that its vitals showed through the transparent skin. It curled its body into the same defensive attitude.
"I reckon you'll get your gong," said the cockney.
"Yes," said Garrick. He didn't want it. He wanted Sean back.